Hello, and welcome to Speak On It, History and Genealogy Conversations with Janice and Sharicana. We invite you to join us on Thursdays at 8 p.m. for an engaging exchange with us and our special guest as we cover various topics regarding history, genealogy, and your personal family history stories. Hello, I'm Janice Gilliard.
And I'm Sharicana Feliciano. Welcome to Speak On It, History and Genealogy Conversations with Janice and Sharicana. Thank you for joining us, and be sure to check us out on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Today, we are joined by our guest, Adrian G. Whaley.
Adrian G. Whaley is an educator and history lover who currently serves as Director of Education and Community Engagement at the Museum of the American Revolution. Adrian earned her bachelor's degree in African American Studies from Harvard University and her master's in education from the University of Pennsylvania. She has worked in both art and history museums, including the Museum of Modern Art in New York, the African American Museum in Philadelphia, and the Smithsonian's Anacostia Community Museum, and loves the potential for objects, artifacts, and primary source documents to enrich student learning experiences.
Adrian carries her love of history and for uncovering the stories of common people into her spare time as an avid genealogist, researching her own family history, and as programming chair and former president of Philadelphia's African American Genealogy Group. As both a museum educator and genealogist, she has presented on television and in workshops and conferences, both locally and nationally. Welcome to Speak On It, Adrian Whaley.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
We're happy to have you here.
So excited to have you here. So Adrian, thank you so much for joining us. So we learned about you during a Zoom presentation celebrating the historic Eden Cemetery in Philadelphia and from several television segments, especially the Black Patriots, Heroes of the Revolution documentary. We are or were impressed with your passion for sharing with our youth that the history of this country is a shared history and that their ancestors played a significant role in its development. Also, how genealogy and history complement one another. Please share with our listeners why genealogy and history are so important to you and what was the catalyst or the pull that led you in this direction as far as your education and career?
That is such a good set of questions. So I think there's probably two different ways to answer. One of them is that some school projects actually really got me interested in both history and genealogy. So I'm born and raised in Philadelphia. I went to Masterman for middle school and high school here in the city. And when I was in high school, we did this class, I think as a part of, or we did this project as a part of our AP US history class, where we went to a historic cemetery in West Philadelphia called the Woodlands. And we were supposed to only bring with us things that people in the Victorian era in like the mid to late 19th century would have taken with them, glass bottles and brown paper bags and sandwiches wrapped in wax paper and things like that. And back when it was okay to take like a gravestone rubbing, we did that. And we each did some research on the person whose gravestone we had done the rubbing of. We went around to archives all around the city of Philadelphia, the Historical Society of Pennsylvania, the Philadelphia History Museum, the Balch Institute, the Library Company of Philadelphia, all sorts of places like that. And we learned how to research the history of one person's life. At the around the same time that we were doing that, in our English class, we were reading a book by Toni Morrison called Song of Solomon. I don't know if you have read that book. For folks who are listening, if you haven't read it, I'm going to spoil it for you right now. So close your ears if you don't want to hear this. But what I thought was so fascinating about this book is that the main character's name is Milkman. And occasionally throughout the book, he hears people singing this song while they're playing kids' games like, you know, hopscotch and jump rope and things like that. They're singing this song. And he discovers over the course of the story that the song that they're singing is actually about his family. It's telling his family history. And so at the same time that I was learning how to research one person's life through actual historical sources, I was reading about a person, fictional though they were, discovering their own family history. And that just got me really interested in thinking about history and genealogy and, you know, topics like that. And Related to that is my second answer. So I said that I was born and raised in Philadelphia, but I'm first generation born and raised in Philadelphia. Neither of my parents is from here. Both of them ended up here for education. So I've got people in Ohio, I've got people in Washington, DC, and I did not grow up like at my grandparents' knee. You know, I didn't grow up surrounded by my aunts and uncles. I didn't grow up surrounded by my cousins. I had opportunities to see them, but I was not steeped in any sort of family history, any sort of family stories that I might have gotten if I had grown up closer to them. And so I think that I just sort of realized, hey, you can do this research. You can find your family histories. I don't know a ton about my family history. Maybe I could do this research and find out about my family history. And that just, it lit a fire. That's why I ended up majoring in African American studies. That is, I think, part of why I ended up working in history museums. It is certainly why I've been so involved in genealogical projects and in the African American genealogy group here in Philadelphia.
That is great. And you know what? I'm glad that you mentioned Philadelphia because, and you referenced the fact that, you know, you're first generation and from Philly. And do you feel like, before we get to the next question, Philly is such a historic city. I mean, you mentioned, you know, all of the institutions, like at least four institutions, and that's kind of just scratching the surface of what, you know, Philly has. It is such a rich city, such has such rich Black history. It's one of my favorite cities to visit. Do you feel like Philly, like what a role that Philly may have played in your pull, so to speak, whether it was to sort of maybe offset the fact that you didn't grow up around, like you said, at your grandmother's knee. I'm curious to know if Philly, like, you know, just being in that city did anything for you.
That is, ooh, that's a really interesting question, because I didn't learn really about those sorts of resources that the city had. And I didn't really, I think, know about, like, you know about the Declaration of Independence, you know about the Constitutional Convention, you know that it happens in Philadelphia. We've got the Liberty Bell. So there's that piece of it. But I don't think I really connected with sort of the possibilities for historical exploration really until I started digging into those projects in high school. I think that, you know, we become really almost desensitized to our cities. You know, how many people in New York City actually visit the Statue of Liberty?
You just see.
Right.
Or the fact that your history could be connected right in your own backyard. Exactly. You could be connected to it and not even know it.
Exactly. Right. You just go about your day-to-day life with the day-to-day institutions that you're affiliated with, and that's sort of it. So I didn't really appreciate any of those things until later on. And of course, now I'm just like living it all the time, every day.
So true. Yeah, we do take it for granted. And to clarify for listeners and for folks there, I have been to the Statue of Liberty as a New Yorker. But to your point, I don't think I would have gone had it not been for like a school trip, right? So, you know, we definitely take these things for granted, for sure. So in your professional career, you are the Director of Education and Community Engagement at the Museum of the American Revolution. And in one of your media interviews, you said, quote, essentially, most of my adult life has been me finding diverse ways to make sure that people have access to the stories and the resources to make sure that this history is not forgotten and that we can do better in the future, end quote. Does this position provide you opportunities for you to make that happen?
Absolutely. Yes, for sure. So I'm super lucky to be in the position that I am and to work with the team that I do, because being in charge of education and community engagement means that I am working with and leading this team of amazing, brilliant, funny, creative people who are designing all of the family programs and resources that people engage with for our museum. They're designing all of the school experiences for both students and teachers, workshops, professional development sessions, talks and tours, and all sorts of things like that. All of the first and third person costumed interpretation interactions that people have, whether it's a play that we're putting on or whether it's interacting with someone who's just dressed up in the clothing of someone from the 18th century, but still being their 21st century self and just being like, hey, let me tell you about these really old clothes that I have on, or these clothes that look really old. You know, I get to work with the people who are in charge of designing like the the themed discovery carts that we have, the gallery talks that we do, walking tours that we do outside of our building. And our mission at the institution is to uncover and share compelling stories about the diverse people and the complex events that sparked America's ongoing experiment in liberty, equality, and self-government. Diversity is built into that mission, and diverse stories are woven throughout the entirety of our core exhibit. And we always find ways to lift up diverse stories in our special exhibitions and in our other spaces as well. So it's never a struggle to, we never have to convince somebody internally that like, oh, well, we have to make sure that we're going to tell a story about people of indigenous ancestry, or we have to make sure that we're going to include women or people of African descent. We all know that it's important. And I think even beyond that, we all know that to not include those stories is actually to be irresponsible historians.
Mm-hmm.
Which
has that been the history, though? Has that been the history of the museum, or is that more recent?
The museum is brand new. We just celebrated our fifth anniversary in April of this year. So that has been a part of what the institution does from the get-go. So when you come through our exhibits, our core exhibits, which always sort of have the same key elements, but lots of objects and lots of like little individual stories will rotate out as we get new things and have to return some of the things that we had, you're going to find stories about the French and the Spanish individuals who became a part of the British Empire at the end of the French and Indian War. And you're going to think about diversity when it comes to religion, because people think about the British Empire and being Protestant, but now you've got a bunch of Catholic folks that are part of the mix. How are they going to be treated, right? You have to think about the folks who are, as I said, Native American, right? And the fact that there are tens of thousands of them on this land and that they're from all different backgrounds. They're Stockbridge, they're Cherokee, they're Lenni Lenape or Delaware, they're Oneida, they're Tuscarora, they're all of these different groups of people who are different from one another. You have to think about like the different waves of people of African descent who generally were brought here against their will and had memories of Africa or from parents who had memories of Africa, right? Mm-hmm. And so you'll see those stories. You'll learn about Phyllis Wheatley. You're going to learn about James Fortin. You're going to learn about Elizabeth Freeman. You're going to get these, all of these different stories. And it's even built into like the resources and the interactives that we have created from the core gallery experience, whether it's a gallery guide, whether it's an online interactive like Finding Freedom, which explores stories of five people of African descent who were all in Virginia in 1781, but who had very different experiences. Right. It's always been a key part of what we do. And sometimes people get really excited about this, and they also want to know like, how come I didn't learn this in school? Which I think is like such a good question. For so many reasons. And we love getting that question, even though we also hate getting that question. We love it because it means that we are changing the narrative.
Right.
You know? So changing and correcting the narrative. And one thing that you just said that I love, and that is memories of Africa.
Yeah.
I have a document for an ancestor who they left South Carolina, went to Georgia, and it's documented that he said, because we wanted, they had more opportunities there after being enslaved, but they remembered their families or ancestors in Africa, and they wanted to go back there. They ended up staying in Georgia. They changed their minds for whatever reason, but that just struck a nerve with me, memories of Africa. And then that question of why wasn't I taught that in school? And Jarkon and I've talked about this a number of times where, you know, you're taught history and there's this disconnect. And as family historians and genealogists, when you realize how your family connects with that historical timeline, I always use the line, game on. It just changes everything. Uh-huh. And I'm sitting here listening to you and thinking, you don't have boring days. There's nothing to worry about your job.
I'm never bored. I'm certainly never bored. And I love your enthusiasm about this idea of memories of Africa. It reminds me of, there's this history book by a historian whose name is John Fanning Watson, who's writing about Philadelphia. And he often interviews people who had been in the city for a long time, people who were aged and who remembered things that had happened way, way back in the past. And I want to say that he's doing the recording of this history maybe in like the early to like early teens and 20s in the 1800s. And he's got a couple of anecdotes where he has a woman who's recollecting what happens in one of the historic squares in Philadelphia called Washington Square. And the woman remembers that there would be hundreds of people of African descent who were gathered on weekends and holidays who are singing the songs of their ancestors and speaking in their native tongues and dancing the dances of their homelands, and that they're gathering there and they're eating and they're also pouring beverages, they're pouring liquids onto the ground. And that ground was a potter's field where a number of enslaved people of African descent had been buried. They're pouring libations.
Yes.
You know, like they had these memories. You see in Runaway ads, some people who are described as having their country marks, right? They still have the traditional like ritual scarification on their faces from when they were raised in Africa. So
when you said dances, that made me think of in the Gullah Geechee community of the ring shout, the ring shout dance that they do.
Yeah. Yep.
Our history is not totally lost. Oh, okay, I feel like I'm in church.
Yeah, that was amazing.
That was powerful. You were featured in the History Channel series, Black Patriots, Heroes of the Revolution, documentary produced by and narrated by Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Deborah Morales. What was the focus of your segment? And do you think there's room for improvement in our educational system to include Black Patriots? Because most of us didn't learn this in school.
Oh boy. Yeah, so I was so lucky to get to participate in that History Channel documentary, and I was invited to talk about all manner of things related to people of African descent in the revolutionary era, and to just really lift up some of the stories that people hadn't heard of in the past. And I mean, this gets us back to that point about what are the opportunities that exist in the school system. And I'll say that there are some places where it's getting better. So we know that there are some moves afoot around the country to try to maybe not tell the depth and breadth of America's true history, right? We're sort of seeing all of that happen. But one of the things that we are actually experiencing at our institution is that both teachers and students really, really want to know about Black history.
Awesome.
Our student workshop, Whose Liberty, is our highest booked workshop at the museum.
Wow.
Like our teacher professional development experiences that focus on people of African descent are our highest booked teacher PDs. Like people
are hungry for this. Yeah.
They're absolutely hungry for this. And I think a part of what we're seeing is that people have a fundamental misunderstanding of what history is and how it works. Mm-hmm. So people think that history is like a mathematical equation and 1 + 1 = 2. And that there's no interpretation that needs to be done. History actually functions, though, more like science and scientific almost experimentation, or truly like scientific refinement, right? Mm. So when a scientist learns a thing, they don't assume that that is fact forever. If new information comes around, they change their conclusions.
Right.
This is the same thing with history. If new information comes to light, because new primary sources are still becoming available from the American Revolution, right? If historians ignored the new sources, they're not doing the work correctly, right? People discover new ways of analyzing information. They start to take into account whose voices were not heard in the past, which perspectives were not being listened to and paid attention to, and they incorporate that into new analyses of the past. And every product of history is produced in a specific historical context. And so later historians, even future historians beyond us, they're going to look back at our moment in time and they're going to say, well, these works were produced then. Here's what was happening then. And here's how that probably shaped how they were interpreting the past. That's a process that has to keep happening and should keep happening. So people talk about revisionist history as though that is like some sort of scary, like four-letter word, bad phrase. But revising our understanding of the past based on new information and new methods of analysis are critically important. So I just had to say all of that. So, okay, the question is, do you think there is room for improvement? Yes. And I think that as many teachers as they can are oftentimes trying to do more and get more information. And man, I have so much sympathy for social studies and history teachers because they have new stuff to teach every year. Right. History keeps happening, for one thing. And imagine all of the things that a teacher is supposed to be expert in over the course of like 1 year with one grade of students. And then imagine that you are an elementary school teacher and you're responsible for all of the social studies classes for each of the grades. There's no way that any of us can be experts in all of that. But teachers are trying to do the work in so many cases. They're seeking out resources, they're asking questions. And I think that we have to be unafraid. We have to not back down when people ask us to not speak the truth. We have to say, this is the history. These are the documents. And more than that, I think we need to teach people how to be effective consumers of information about history and about what's happening in schools and classrooms. We need to teach them critical thinking skills, historical thinking skills, yes, so that they understand how to analyze documents, you know, and figure out what conclusions they can draw.
Or if a teacher or someone is so bent on sticking to the old, what about this? And not only students, I think a lot of adults who have been taught one thing, and you know, because of access, all of the different, all of the information that's available on the internet, especially with Google Books, I think a lot of people are going, well, wait a minute, I didn't learn this, and something's not adding up. And so, as Tara kind of just mentioned, I think that there's this hunger for, wait a minute, we missed a lot. Something's wrong here. This doesn't make sense, and we can't continue this is what we've always taught, and this is what we're going to stick with. And I was listening to you. I'm like, too late. It is too late. You can't turn back. And there are more people wanting to know the truth and correcting the narrative. So it's too late. It's too late. And I think that's why you have that major issue with critical race theory, that folks are like, no, just stick to this. Stick to this. Again, too late. Too late.
If we focus on what is available in terms of primary sources, if we focus on what are the tools and the means that we have to critically and thoughtfully analyze what happened in the past, and then let's think about how we communicate history to all of the people who need to understand it, so that when we say that America is the greatest country on earth, right, which is a thing that we hear a lot of people say, let's live into that. Let's make those words mean something by learning from the past and becoming a version of the nation that is better for all Americans.
Great answer. Amen. So we noted that you worked on a segment for the StoryCorps online archive with one of your colleagues, Robert Dunkerley, about the role of women in the American Revolution. Can you tell us about this experience? Because most people don't think of women having a role in the American Revolution. And do you encourage or challenge family genealogists and historians to look for Black patriots connected to their families?
Good question. So one of the things that we are really clear about at the Museum of the American Revolution is that we're not the Museum of the Revolutionary War.
Right.
So the Revolutionary War was 8 years. The American Revolution was at least 30 years, the way that we define it, from the like mid or early to mid 1760s to at least 1790. And we actually make the argument that we might still be in the American Revolution, right? We are still a very young nation compared to many of the nations on earth. We are 250 years old, basically, almost, you know, if you're counting from 76. And so it's important for us to have people think about the revolution, not just as a military conflict, but as a moment of change that is social and political and economic and religious and like all of these different things. And when you look at it like that, which aspect of American life is not touched? And is it possible that you can take like half of the population, right? Or like one whole gender or sex and just ignore their participation in the lived daily experiences of 30 years or more of life? So people tend to think, okay, American Revolution, Revolutionary War, battlefield. So number one, there are women with the army. They're camp followers. So we tend to hear stories about like the exceptional stories of somebody like Deborah Sampson, who dresses as a man and serves as a soldier for about a year in the Continental Army, right? You hear a story like that, or you maybe hear a story of somebody like Mary Lidwig, I think it is, or Margaret Hayes, people who were helping to bring water to the battlefield so that they could cool down the cannons that their husbands were responsible as part of a crew for firing in the heat of battle. So you hear these stories. Those are the Molly Pitcher names that people tend to think of. Mm-hmm. They get collapsed into that story. But those are kind of exceptional in a way. But there are like thousands of camp followers involved in all of the different major armies that are a part of the Revolutionary War, the Continental Wow. Army, so the Americans, the British, the Hessians who side with the British, the French Army, they and their children are traveling with the army and performing critical duties like nursing and laundering clothes and materials and things like that. They're serving as, sutlers, selling goods to the soldiers that they need. And for the women who are providing key services, they're actually getting paid rations from the army. They are on the army's payroll. So they might get like half rations and their kids might get quarter rations for the service that they're providing.
Interesting.
And that's just the battle side of it. But like, there's also the home front. There are the women who were making all sorts of goods and supplies, like the ones who took a statue of King George III that had been pulled down in New York. And they basically melt it down and turn it into musket balls. That's women and children who were doing that work. There are women in Philadelphia who are fundraising for the Continental Army and then sewing a bunch of shirts for the Continental Army so that they have clean, well-structured clothing to wear to make them feel fresh and help them feel like they can continue on in this fight. You've got women who are running businesses. You've got women who are running farms and serving as deputy husbands, quote unquote, helping to make sure that things happen when many of the men in a bunch of different towns get up and leave for 3 months, for 8 months, for a year, for 3 years, for the entirety of the war. So women are involved just all over the place. And that includes Native American women who were involved on and off of battlefields, serving as scouts, serving behind their beside their husbands, like Two Kettles Together did at the Battle of Oriskany. You've got free and enslaved women of African descent who were involved in all sorts of different things. And we can't forget that there are this quote unquote like Black patriots that served with the revolutionaries, but about three times as many served with the British. Right, or found some way to support
Black loyalists.
Right.
And that includes women who run away during this time at much higher numbers than you see women run away at other points in time during the period of enslavement. Mostly, you know, over the entire period, it's men and especially young men who are running away. But you see women and you see elders running in numbers like they had not seen before or since, really, going to the British. And they're heavily involved in all sorts of things. So it's a big story. It's an expansive story. And yes, it has to include women. And then in terms of how I'm encouraging people or whether I'm encouraging people to look for Black patriots in particular, I think what I would say is do the research methodically. So we all know people who have been like, I think I'm related to President so-and-so. And they just immediately jump back in time and they miss something huge. And like, that's not even their family. So be diligent.
It's not even their family alone.
Right. Be methodical. Do the good genealogical research that folks like you all and others are training genealogists to do generation by generation, collecting as much information as you can, but listen out when you hear interesting stories. Right. Pay attention. Maybe there's a thing that gets mentioned about like, maybe there's something that's been passed down in the family in terms of like a physical artifact that has to do with the revolution. Right. Maybe there's a story that there was a soldier. Maybe there's a name that sort of sticks out because you've heard that that's also the name of, I don't know, a military commander who was from the same location that your ancestor was from. Maybe there's some sort of a connection there. Maybe they have a surname like Freeman or Freedom or Free or Liberty. There is this entire grouping of African descended men who were in Connecticut's 4th Regiment in the Continental Army, who all have names like Cuff Liberty and Dick Liberty and Ned Freedom and things like that. They're claiming their status, you know, Elizabeth Freeman, right? She said in her name when she wins her court case. You know, so those might be things to look for. But what I don't want people to do is just be like, I bet I have a Black patriot. Let me start there.
Right.
What I want them to do is follow the trail if they think that it's there while being diligent, strong historians and genealogists.
Right.
But do not rule that possibility out. There's somewhere around 5,000 to 8,000 African-American men who were serving within the Continental Army, probably more that are in the various militias all around. There are, somewhere around 15 or more that are serving with the British. There are pension records that are out there. There are all sorts of documents. There's bounty land applications. There's the quote unquote Book of Negroes for folks who served with the British or at least who departed with the British from New York in particular. So if you have an inkling, then follow the thread because there are resources out there, but just be careful to not jump to conclusions before it makes sense to do so.
One of the things that I'm hearing some folks are starting to share is that their enslaved ancestor fought for their master. Mm-hmm. Do you run in the war? Do you see a lot of that or hear a lot of that?
So we've definitely heard that that happens. And I know that there's documentation in some cases to support this. It's one of those things where it's a little bit tricky. And so I don't want to make any statements really in one way or the other. Because individual circumstances really change. It might be from location to location. It really can be person to person. And how often it says that a person serves for their master or their owner, or whatever it is, you know, sometimes the records aren't clear on that, but the oral history or other documents outside of the military records might actually be the things that substantiate that service.
Especially if a lot of them are getting land immediately after the war and all of a sudden you were enslaved and you just got all this land. It's okay. So
definitely there's questions that you want to ask there. Now, a good number of people actually get their freedom because of their service. And so that can be sort of a triggered process, right? So they get their freedom because of their service. They apply for a pension, they apply for bounty land. That could be because of, and in many cases is because of their own personal service in the revolution.
And another thing that we always stress is that it's so important to study the history of wherever your ancestors was, study the history and that timeline, because that can help you answer so many questions.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Absolutely. Study your region, study the history of the military units, if that's what you're interested in. Mm-hmm. Study the timelines, understand the social context, who were the big players in your community. Like, think about context at like every level and under like every theme that you can think of relating to your person's life.
Okay. Absolutely.
So you created Through Their Eyes, a field trip program at the museum. What are the objectives of this type of trip? And what is one of your most memorable experiences? One or two, actually, if you want.
Yes. Okay. So the objectives for Through Their Eyes, there's a couple of them. One of them at a base level is just to encourage historical empathy. So to get to know and see through the eyes of somebody who is different from you across space, across time, across life experience, and to recognize that they're real people who have, like, even if they're different from you and they had different perspectives than what you might have had at that time, that they might have had valid reasons for feeling the way that they did, coming from the life experience and the perspectives that they had. One of the things that we're hoping is that historical empathy can actually support the practice of contemporary empathy, right? That people will be able to practice that in their everyday lives as well. Clearly, that's a muscle that always needs to be flexed and exercised, but we're hoping that this is contributing to that. So that's part of it. Another part of it is just at a base level to see people of the revolution as real flesh and blood people who are just the same in terms of making informed decisions, having thoughts, having feelings and emotions and all of those sorts of things as us today. So, you know, people often see images of the revolution and, you know, it's like watercolor paintings, it's oils, it's drawings, it's things like that. And it can be easy to imagine that those people are not actually like us. They're not actually human like us. They didn't really live in the world, you know, and that's exacerbated by the fact that there aren't photographs of the revolutionary era. But one of the things, here's another spoiler alert, one of the things that's actually built into the Through Their Eyes experience is an opportunity for young people to see photographs of people who were living during the revolution, who lived into the age of photography.
Oh, amazing. So,
1830s, 40s, 50s, 60s. photography exists, and there are hundreds of photographs of people who were alive when George Washington and Thomas Jefferson were, who sit for photographs, including somebody like a man named Caesar, who was living in like around Albany, New York. He probably met and knew Alexander Hamilton. There's a guy named Isaac Granger who has his photo taken. He and his family were owned by Thomas Jefferson when Jefferson was writing the Declaration of Independence. You know, like there's a woman who's actually, she passes away after living for many years in Philadelphia. She says that she was from a place called Frog Hollow, close to Valley Forge. And that when she was a kid, she saw George Washington's troops marching on their way to their winter encampment at Valley Forge. And that she begged the person who either owned her as an enslaved person or maybe was her master as an indentured servant, it's unclear. But she says that she begged him to allow her to get like clothing and blankets and shoes and food and things like that to give to the soldiers as they were passing by. Well, there's a photo of her.
That's very cool.
Yeah, so making them real is another piece of this. And then, of course, what we want to do is we want them to understand the American Revolution better and to understand that people didn't know the outcome. We know the outcome. And so it can seem obvious that, of course, all of these were the right decisions to make. But did they appear that way at the time? All of it was tenuous. No one knew what was going to happen. Most people assumed the British were going to win.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, allowing them that sense of tenuousness and just trying to see through other people's eyes and be more well-informed about the revolution in general. That's what we're aiming for.
Is there a student experience that stands out to you?
Yeah. So honestly, I think that my favorite moments are, so the Through Their Eyes experience, it starts off by giving the students each student gets one of 18 different character cards, we call them, where one side has like signs and symbols of the American Revolution. And then the other side has information about a specific person. It's got like their name. It's got what year they were born. It has where they live. It's got how old they were when the first shots of the Revolutionary War were fired. It's got a little information about their jobs or their parents' jobs. And then it's got like 3 to 4 snippets about their lives over the entire course of the Revolution. And so as the students are going through the experience, they're getting asked to think about their person's experience. So it's not just about George Washington and Thomas Jefferson. It's also about Abraham Wheelwright and Caesar and George Fishley and Teyona Wayute and folks like that. And so the students are trying to understand their experiences. What they don't know is that at the end of the core galleries is that wall of photographs, and that we chose the people to research for those character cards from the photos that we had on the wall. So
that.
You come around the corner and all of a sudden you see these pictures and we say, guess what? You can find your person. And the way that that blows students' minds is just, it is so amazing to watch. They get deeply invested in finding their person and reading the little bit of information that we put on the pictures. And it just, it makes everything click for them. It makes them real. That is my favorite thing all of the time. My second favorite thing is that immediately next to that, we have a wall of mirrors. And in between the mirrors, it has a couple of words. It says, meet the future of the American Revolution.
Oh.
So you cannot leave our exhibit without seeing yourself as a piece of this ongoing story.
I love that. Wow.
One more thing. Was there ever a point in your experience where someone was emotional, had an emotional response as you were sharing that, just, you know, an
for
emotional
sure.
response like wow, or even crying? You know, I know for me as a person of color, you know, being Black and doing research, there are times where I do have emotional experiences if I'm reading something or it just moves me. So have you observed that?
Often. Yeah. It can range from sort of surprise and sometimes distress or anger about why didn't I know this before? That's often something that we get from adults. Sometimes when they're reading the stories about individual people, you know, they'll start to tear up because it's moving in a way that they weren't expecting. They didn't know that they were going to get that emotionally involved.
Mm.
Right.
We have, when we tell the story of Elizabeth Freeman, we do that in a gallery that also always has a copy of the Declaration of Independence. So like a real copy of the Declaration. We're not talking like a Xerox or something. We're talking like it's a broadside or it's from a newspaper that was published in 1776 and those sorts of things. So we've got that. And then we've got the story of Elizabeth Freeman. It also, there's also a story about Abigail Adams. There's a story about, who is it? Is it George Findlay or William Findlay? Basically, what we're saying is we've got the Declaration of Independence. It's got these high ideals. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. And then among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Mm-hmm. But to whom do those words apply?
Right.
Do they apply to poor or laboring class white men? Do they apply to women? Do they apply to people of African descent, whether they're free or enslaved? Uh-huh. When we ask those questions, and we've got the Elizabeth Freeman story there, we also have a pair of shackles that are really small. Most people look at them, most adults, and they go, those are really small. Those wouldn't fit on me. That's because they're children's shackles. Mm. And so the conversations that you can have around that and the questions about why would a child need to be shackled? And what does that say about some of the contradictions of our nation at its founding moment are really powerful. And, you know, having it right there with the story of Elizabeth Freeman, who basically sues for her freedom and wins, right? And then really claims her status in her name. Sometimes we have students whose last name is Freeman.
Wow.
And they wonder, like, is that where my name came from? Did one of my ancestors get their freedom in a way like this? And then they changed it. So that's really powerful for sure.
Wow.
But we've had like West African, like Senegalese or Gambian young people connect with the story of Phyllis Wheatley because she's from Senegambia in West Africa. And so
thinking about her life.
Mm-hmm. So like all sorts of connections can be made throughout and people can react emotionally in any number of ways.
That was a great question, Janice. I'm glad you asked that. Really was
trying to, you know, as like, I just gotta get that, you know.
I gotta get that in there. So Adrian, are you currently working on any new projects, collections that you can discuss at this time with our listeners? And are there any special exhibits on display at the Museum for Black Patriots? Kind of touched on some of this.
Good question. So I'll start with the second question, actually. Are there any special exhibits about Black Patriots? So one of the challenges, one of the design challenges of the museum was how to tell the stories of sort of specific maybe groups or types of groups of people, right? You think about like Native American or Indigenous people. You think about women, you think about children, you think about people of African descent. So one way of telling the stories is to have like a room for each of those groups, right? And the benefit of that is that you can always tell people, you're interested in this story, go over there, that's where you're gonna find it. And it becomes like a very obvious thing.
Right.
What it does though, is that that removes those stories from the chronology and the context of how they actually were experiencing the revolutionary moment.
Mm.
So the other way that you can do this is you can weave all of those stories into the places where they actually fit within the larger narrative of the American Revolution, recognizing that you're always making choices about whose stories to tell when, and that there's all sorts of different ways that you can weight things, but that you're trying to get a diversity of different kinds of experiences and making sure that they fit within the contextual, chronological, and geographical flow of the story. Mm-hmm. The challenge of that is that it can be harder to point people to, oh, you're interested in like Black stories, then here's the one place that you can go and get all of the things. So both of those have pros and cons. We chose the second approach though, because we thought that rooting the stories of all of these different groups of people in the specific context where they make the most sense would be sort of the way to help people understand that they weren't just like, it wasn't like Black people over here and Native Americans over here. No, it was that there were Marbleheaders who were with the Continental Army and helping George Washington cross the Delaware. And that when we think about life on board a privateer ship, James Fortin was there. We decided to do that, but we use other types of resources, audio guides, gallery guides that are handheld, paper-based, so that you can find some of those stories in a more sort of focused way. So hopefully that answers that piece of the question. And then in terms of things that we're excited about, so I just said all that about like not separating out stories, et cetera, but when we do special exhibitions, we have the opportunity to focus in on really particular kinds of stories.
Right.
So we are super, super excited that opening in February of 2023 is going to be an exhibit called Black Founders, the Fortin Family of Philadelphia.
Oh, cool.
Yes.
So, I wanted to put a drum roll in there, but you beat me to it. But yes, okay, all right, go ahead.
If you want, I can say it again, and then you can put it in drum roll. But we're really excited about this because, not to tell his whole story, but James Fortin is born in Philadelphia in 1766. He hears the Declaration of Independence read for the first time on the grounds of the Pennsylvania State House in 1776. He's just 10 years old, and he's born free. His father was free. His mother may have been enslaved. It's possible. But he is definitely born by the time that she is free. He hears all of these people. He's like raised around like 3rd and Walnut, 3rd and Chestnut Streets, right in the area where the museum is. And so all of the people that we think of when we think about the Continental Congress, when we think about folks like George Washington and Alexander Hamilton and John Adams and like all those folks, they're walking around where he is. They're in their carriages. They're having conversations. Sound is spilling out of the rooms that they're staying in at night and all of these things. And he gets sort of inflamed by this like passion around revolution, independence, liberty, equality, all of these things. He eventually sails on a privateer ship when he's 14 years old, basically helping to be like a legal pirate to harass the British. He does that for 2 sailings. He actually at one point is captured by the British and is put on a prison ship in New York Harbor for around a year. When he eventually makes it back to Philadelphia, he ends up running a sailmaking loft right on the Delaware River. He becomes one of the wealthiest men in Philadelphia. His business oversees men of a number of different races and nationalities. He is involved in money lending. He is a real estate investor. And the influence and the money that he gains because of all of those things, he uses them for abolitionist and anti-slavery causes. And he builds this family and is a part of this community that are fighting to make early Pennsylvania, early Philadelphia, and the early nation as a whole live into their revolutionary ideals, to actually make true the words that they said, right? And he will call them out very directly on it when he needs to. And the family that he raises, they just keep being involved in these things. His wife and some of his daughters helped to found the Philadelphia Female Anti-Slavery Society. He has children and grandchildren who were involved in the Civil War as soldiers. One is a nurse. Charlotte Fortin Grimke actually goes down to South Carolina, and she's a part of the Port Royal experience, helping to educate newly freed people. So like, this is the Fortin family. And right. Then their community. So we're going to be telling that story through amazing artifacts, including some that we are getting on loan from descendants of the Fortin family.
That's exciting.
Which is just, it is so exciting. It is bonkers and it is great. and so that is going to be on display from February through November of 2023.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So we hope that gives people a lot of time to come check it out. So that's the upcoming exhibit. But the other thing I have to tell you all about, even though this isn't going to be public facing for a little while yet, we recently acquired approximately 200 documents from New England, specifically from Connecticut and Rhode Island, that have information about the service of Indigenous and African descended people of color who served in the Continental Army.
Oh my goodness.
So we have been conserving them, right, to make sure that they're in like good condition to be handled and all sorts of things like that. And then our plan is to make these digitally available on our website so that people can go through them. They can, you know, search for their ancestors. They can search for, you know, the sorts of information to compile data sets and all sorts of things like that. And then we also want to use that to build some story-based interactives, like some of the other things that people will find on our website and in our galleries, to make these people not just names on documents, but like fully fleshed out individuals who lived lives.
Yeah, so I'll be the person that when they send out the press release that it's going to be available, I'll be staying up like midnight, you know, for whatever.
Like,
because I have somebody on the 1777 military census out of Rhode Island, and we can't find proof of the service, so I will be waiting for that.
Oh,
I know,
man.
You shared that at Sons and Daughters at their conference. you shared that that was going to be available. But, so I'm so glad you put that out there because I was getting ready to ask.
Absolutely. Yes, that is the Patriots of Color Archive.
Oh, that's awesome. I had to get my jaw up off the floor when you said like what you guys have. That's really special.
Yeah. If any volunteers for that, I'll come up too.
That in mind, because we might need help from the genealogical community, and we really want this stuff to be useful. Exactly. We want, like, part of my job is community engagement. And I mean, you all know this as well as, if not better than a lot of folks, there are many people that don't picture people of color as a part of the American Revolution.
Thank you. Yeah. Right? And that's why you're our guest tonight, to help change that narrative.
Yes, exactly. And the thing is, we have to change that not only like in white communities, right? But also within our own community.
Absolutely.
It's so important that we let people know we were there. You might find your story there too. We are a part of this history.
Yes, we've always been there. I'm going to say that very calmly. We've always been everywhere. Always, and correcting that.
Okay. True to this, not new to this, as I would say.
Yes, yes. So, Adrian, what are some parting words of inspiration? And sure enough, we've had quite a bit already. Mm-hmm. Or 3 to 4 tips that you would like to share with our listeners?
I think my parting words would be, number one, just going back to what we were just saying, don't assume that the revolution isn't about you or about us, because you might be surprised. And there's so many resources. There's so many resources available, not only at museums and other historical sites, but there are books and there are journal articles and all sorts of things like that. So dig in, do a little research. You might be surprised. I'll just put that out there. But also, I think I would say, just genealogically speaking, search for the whole story. So as a researcher, I know that we can often get really excited just about like vital records and how many people we can put in our trees and, you know, where we're from in Africa. But every single person on that tree has a story that is more than just their beginning and end dates and the people that they married and raised.
I love that.
So find all the stories, read every newspaper from their community, find out what they're saying about your folks and the folks around them. Figure out where they went to school, if they had that opportunity, dig into the educational records, right? See what community organizations were around, see if your family members were a part of that, build the whole story, flesh out the skeleton of the dates, put some meat on those bones so that you can tell these stories for the generations that come after.
Hey, one more time, say it again. Put some meat on those bones.
Put the meat on those bones, so that you can tell the full stories for the generations that come after you.
Ah, I'm so bad visually, but I just envision the ancestors with the bones going, "Can you put some meat on me, please? my story, I'm waiting." Wow. And I'm thinking, and this is not a religious show, but I'm thinking of the scripture, you know, can these bones live? Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, they can. Oh, okay.
Wow, that was powerful. Okay, a little church tonight, I see. Well, Adrian, thank you so, so much for joining us on Speak On It. We truly enjoyed having you tonight. And to learn more about the Museum of the American Revolution, you can visit amrevmuseum.org. And you can also learn more about Adrian and reach out to her on pinterested.blogspot.com. Thank you for joining us, and we look forward to sharing with you during our next segment of Speak On It.
Speak On It is a podcast and is immediately available to listen to at your leisure. Thank you.